Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. We begin our program with some daily selections from Science of Mind, Guide for Spiritual Living, and the theme for this month is Gentle, Giant Gentleness, Being a Safe Place, a Gentle, Loving Presence, The Struggle is Real, a New Thought Perspective on Climate. What do you magnify? Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. Psalm 30.5. The great have not failed to recognize the appearance of evil, but they have separated the appearance from the reality. Ernest Holmes, The Science of Mind, page 337. Remember the Bible story of Job? There he was, cruising through life, a successful man with vast herds of oxen and camels, a big family, and good health. Then he lost it all. Thieves stole his herds, murdered his children, and painful skin issues plagued him. He started focusing on his misfortunes, which magnified his problems. Though he never fully gave up faith in God, he spoke about his problems, amplifying them. What we remember today is Job's losses and faith in God. What we tend not to realize is that his time of struggle was just a brief episode in Job's long life. Granted, this time in his life was not pleasant, nor do we want to diminish his pain, but his troubles did not continue forever. Amen. To this day, we talk about his problems, forgetting that when it was all over, God doubled his wealth and resources. Job and his wife had 10 more children and 4 generations of grandchildren, and he lived another 140 years. Job had a brief rough spot in a very long life, but it passed. In the total picture of his life, his time of darkness was a finite period. You too might get caught up in a rough patch on your way to your destiny, but it too will pass. Remember the 140 good years rather than the darkest night. Affirmation: my struggles are brief compared to the longevity of my glorious life. And from the same issue, what seeds are you planting? We were planting seeds of change, the fruit of which we might never see. We had to be patient. Michelle Obama. The words we speak is the law of our lives, and nothing hinders its operation but ourselves. Ernest Holmes, A Science of Mind, page 146. A couple of seeds were on the ground, laying next to one another on fertile soil. The first seed said to the second, "I want to grow up and put my roots deep down into the soil. Spring forth from the ground, feel the warmth of the sun, reach for the heavens and blossom to fully express myself." This seed grew up to become a beautiful flower, producing many more seeds. The second seed said to the first, "I'm afraid if I reach my roots into the soil, the ground may be too hard to establish myself. If I'm able to break through the surface, what might I have to face? While my stem is young, it could be damaged by the winds of spring. If I grow flowers, who knows what they might attract? I'd rather wait for a safer time." While the second seed waited for the perfect time to sprout, a chicken came by and added the seed to its lunch. In The Light in the Heart, Roy T. Bennett wrote, "Do not let the memories of your past limit the potential of your future. There are no limits to what you can achieve on your journey through life, except in your mind. We will never know what the future holds. When you hold back out of fear, that anxious energy works to attract its corresponding manifestation." Affirmation: my thought seeds now beautifully and courageously blossom. And from the Daily Word, published by Unity, Bold: I boldly create my life. The world is overflowing with abundance and opportunity, but I may miss out on what the world has to offer if I do not act boldly and take my place in it. I am a spiritual being endowed with so many divine gifts, which I bring into the world as only I can. My thoughts and words have power, and I use the power of my mind wisely to create my life's experience. In the past, I may have been too timid to try new things or call attention to myself, but now I feel empowered to use my divine gifts. God's power and strength are mine. I am blessed with a rich imagination and the power of will to dream big and make the choices that are right for me. I am a spiritual being, boldly living life to the fullest. Freedom. I claim my freedom to be. Throughout my life, I have learned and grown through my more challenging periods. When I have made mistakes, I have corrected them. When I have wanted to move on from resentment, I have practiced forgiveness. Over and over I have grown spiritually as I have healed from my troubles. I may not have noticed it at the time, but I've also gained freedom along the way. There is so much that could have bound me and kept me limited, so much that could have caused me to live a small, unexplored life. As I have deepened in understanding, I have learned spiritual freedom is an aspect of my divine identity. No worldly condition can change that. My troubles will come and go, but I will remain wondrously, gloriously free. And from Mark Nepo's The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, a wisdom moment of trust. If you can't cross over alive, how can you cross when you're dead? Kabir. The need to step into what we fear and, in so doing, disperse its hold on us is powerfully brought to life by a moment in the film Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. After searching everywhere within reason and memory for the Holy Grail, Jones stands on an enormous precipice, a deep chasm before him, the Grail waiting on the other side. His father, wounded and depending on the Grail to heal, cries out possible interpretations of the clues Jones has been given to reach the Grail. After what seems a lifetime of inner debate and escalating fear, he dares, against everything he knows, to step into the void above the chasm. And as he does, an enormous stone foundation appears beneath his feet, a bridge that was there all along. This is a moment of risk and trust, a wisdom moment that repeats itself in our lives in both small and large ways. Over and over, the cup we need to drink from, the ancient, ever-healing cup of wholeness, waits beyond some deep chasm we are afraid to cross. Often we're driven to the edge by the cries and clues of elders and loved ones, only to find that nothing makes sense, that there seems nowhere to go. And then the atom of risk begins to replay itself in those brought to the edge. Then, when all known ways of seeing have failed, we sometimes dare to step into the void. Whether that void is a chasm of purpose or self-esteem, or a ravine in relationship, or a canyon of addiction, this crazy wisdom step, that begins with risk and lands in trust, reveals a foundation that was there all along, but which is only made visible by our risk to think and see in new ways, and our trust to step into what we fear. Breathe deeply and know that even the smallest moment of risk and trust is difficult. Center yourself and meditate on a chasm of your own making. It might be a trench of stubbornness or pride that no one can cross, or the echo of your own pain that isolates you, or the vastness that builds when you're afraid to tell someone the truth of your heart, or the absence of belief that you deserve what waits on the other side. Lean into your chasm gently until the fear subsides. Lean into your chasm and offer, through your breathing, a wordless compassion for yourself and all others in our very human struggle to step with risk and land with trust. We return to Science of Mind now and Molly Kate Brown's monthly column, Revealing Wellness, Inner Knowing. The ability to receive guidance, the deep knowing that arises from the wellspring of mystery within, is something we can cultivate. It is instinctual. It is an innate sense of personal truth that informs us beyond the conjuring of the thinking, analytical mind. It is our internal compass. Receiving, hearing, or feeling the guidance requires a willingness to listen and feel deeply. How do we cultivate the ability to hear the silent music, to feel the wisdom already present within us? Dropping into stillness and trusting ourselves are key. Our atoms, little universes themselves with protons, neutrons, and electrons orbiting their nuclei, contain what underlies and unifies all of existence. While at the apparent level, all is constantly changing, this whir of constant motion arises from the still, silent depths. It's what we are at the most fundamental level. This is the place from which guidance arises. Developing the muscle of awareness allows us to return to this essential place of growth and strength. We must turn our attention inward for guidance to come through. Awareness to the breath, awareness to the body, chest, abdomen, pelvis, back, arms, legs, feet, and hands. When you become aware that you're thinking, return the awareness into the body. Do this for 5 minutes here and there, or practice for 30 minutes or an hour. Every return from thought back to the breath or the body is a bicep curl towards strengthening that guidance muscle. You can do this while walking in nature, taking a bath, listening to the birds or the ocean, driving or washing the dishes. A drop of water falling on rock twice has no impact, but a drop falling on rock persistently and consistently over time carves a hole the size of the Grand Canyon. Finally, we must trust ourselves. Guidance arises in different ways. It can feel like an inspired sense or a contractive no toward a person, place, or opportunity. It can show up as hearing the same thing several times from different sources in a short period of time. It doesn't have to make sense, and turning it off often means facing discomfort of some kind. The more we follow this guidance, the more we find ourselves aligned with our truth. The world needs our courage, our emboldened hearts, more than ever. And from the same issue, an article by Diana J. Ensign, A Gentle, Loving Presence. Look at a tree, how still they are, how deeply rooted in being. Allow nature to teach you stillness. Eckhart Tolle. Trees are wonderful examples of giant gentleness. Mature old-growth trees, in both our urban settings and our rural forests, tower magnificently, providing homes for myriad life forms, ants, bees, cicadas, butterflies, songbirds, owls, bats, and squirrels, to name just a few. Moreover, they impart life-giving benefits to humans and wildlife across the planet. As we approach the celebration of Earth Day on April 22nd, we can perhaps look to these giant trees as a useful metaphor for the gentle strength we likewise carry within and the many gifts we can bestow on others simply by being in loving community with our fellow humans and with Mother Earth. Accessing strength within. In spring, we see lots of saplings, young trees just starting their journey toward greater growth. They need nourishment to thrive, good soil, clean water, abundant sunshine, and ample space. We might ask ourselves what we need to thrive. Similar to the saplings, we also need healthy soil, the spiritual ground on which we do our inner work, along with clean water, sunshine, and space to grow. Just as important for many of us is recognizing those things that hinder our personal wellness: environmental stressors, excessive family conflicts, relentless work demands, high levels of daily anxiety, no doubt negatively affect our well-being. Building stress resilience is crucial. We do so when we allow ourselves time to rest and when we engage in spiritual practices that foster inner calm, such as meditation and prayer. As with many desired outcomes, learning to tap into our interior wellspring of strength while simultaneously becoming a gentle presence in the world begins within. The life of spirit is my life, and its strength is my strength, Ernest Holmes says. The deeper our roots go in our spiritual practices, the stronger we become. Learning to slow down. Our spiritual practices allow us to slow down. By slowing down, both physically and mentally, we can reset what would otherwise be autopilot behaviors. For example, it may be our pattern to habitually react with anger, resentment, or anxiety to the outside stimuli of certain people or situations. With practices such as meditation and prayer, we can instead pause, take a few slow, deep breaths, give ourselves the opportunity to relax, and find the peaceful stillness that exists within ourselves. Returning to our tree analogy, the ancient Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu wrote, "Nature does not hurry, yet everything is accomplished." Taoism places an emphasis on living in harmony and in balance with nature and the world. To live in harmony and balance means we are in sync with our hearts and with the universal life force, that vital energy flowing through us. Holmes agrees, stating, "When we learn to relax physically and mentally, we can feel flowing through us a vital energy, a dynamic force, a great surge of living power." Gentleness as our superpower. As we develop greater harmony with spirit, our gentleness becomes our superpower. Being gentle with ourselves, we align more with who we truly are. In time, we may begin to notice that what other people say and do no longer triggers us or controls our behaviors the way it might have in the past. Becoming gentler with ourselves, we're more likely to let go of old grievances, worry less, and not spend so much time rushing through life fueled by anxiety. Instead, we relax our bodies, calm our thinking, and connect with our hearts. It is there, in our heart space, that we find our gentle strength and learn, like the old growth trees, to stand sturdy in the winds of outer change, chaos, and turmoil. We learn to be self-governing, discerning how we want to be in the world and what is ours to do. What's more, we learn to live in the present moment, not in worrying about the past or fearing the future. Storms may swirl around us, but we are stable, serene, and mighty within. Being a gentle presence in the world. Entering the still giant expanse of our heart space, we are better able to offer compassion, kindness, and gentleness to ourselves, to others, and to the world at large. Poet Walt Whitman reminds us, "I am large, I contain multitudes." In other words, our interior world, our consciousness, is powerful and vast. Holmes says it another way, "I am born of the Spirit, I am in the Spirit, I am the Spirit made manifest." Faith in Spirit leads us to extend our branches outward in service to others. A gentle heart does not have room for violence, hate, or bitterness. On the contrary, it is fully open to being in community with all guests who visit. As such, we can now offer our gentle presence to our fellow humans, regardless of what they bring with them, because we are centered and grounded in who we truly are. Holmes reminds us, we no longer feel that we must have faith in ourselves as isolated beings. Along the spirit path, we naturally begin to expand our practice, our gentleness toward our earth. With a gentle heart, we see birds, butterflies, and squirrels as part of our global family. We know our community of inhabitants encompasses all living beings, and we want to do our part in loving kinship to care for our world. We understand that our roots are interconnected, reaching one another in ways that strengthen us all. Our gentle, loving presence, expressed to ourselves, to our fellow inhabitants, and to nature, enriches our entire world. Deeply rooted in community with our earth home, we appreciate that, as Holmes so aptly says, all life is one life. And from the same issue, we turn to Reverend Dr. Barry Ebert's monthly column, Spiritual Parenting, Love Starts at Home. No matter where you travel, it's the best part of the road. You know it when you're home. From the song, When You're Home, by Barry Ebert. In the precious days when we're together with our children and grandchildren, our primary responsibility is to provide them with a home where they can feel safe and loved. Hopefully, home is a place where they can discover and enjoy who they are. No matter what's going on, when they walk through the door, they feel like they're home. Now that I have a couple of granddaughters in preschool, I think a lot about the gift of growing up in a healthy home environment. The information culture and the frenetic energy of entertainment, gaming, and social media have made the picture of a peaceful, quiet home seem like a scene from an ancient civilization. But all devices come with an off button, which means we still have the power to create a peaceful, creative, and fun atmosphere in our homes. Here are some ideas. Take media fasts. Declare when there will be breaks from screens, and the family will do something else with their time and energy. In this election year, the flood of information and anxiety will be relentless, so commit to regular breaks. Board games are great alternatives to screens for all ages. Read together. Reading isn't just for bedtime. As children get older, take turns reading and learning together. We read the Lord of the Rings series with our boys as they grew up, and when the movies came out, we planned a family outing for each release. A love of reading is a great gift to pass on. Readers are leaders. Do things you love. When parents share the things they love with their children, everyone benefits and draws closer together. Our oldest son is a snowboarder, and he recently sent us a video of his family on the slopes, including our 3-year-old granddaughter. It was amazing to see the joy on their faces and to hear her say, "I'm having fun, Daddy." She loves it because he loves it, and they're starting on a long, fun family adventure together. It all starts at home. Last week, I read an article by Alan J. Hamilton, M.D., The Inner Life of AI Bots, What Their Consciousness Means to Our Future. And there were some interesting sidebars that we didn't get to address, and I wanted to share them this week. Why AI changed so suddenly. No one was talking about AI. The next day, 100 million people had signed up to use it, and people began asking me, why? The answer involves a technological leap that came about in 2017. Up until then, if you were working in computer technology, you were working on image analysis, language processing, or predictive analytics, and you were more or less in your own silo. But that all changed with the introduction of transformers. Transformers represent a new kind of thought engine, a universal symbology to interconnect diverse forms of data using language. A transformer basically looks at any data from a CT scan or a series of medical labs or whatever and says, this is a language. It then asks what the next word is likely to be. Think of it like the autocorrect on your phone or computer. So if you have a CT scan, it will look at a series of pixels and guess what the next pixel looks like. Or if all of a patient's labs look a certain way, the transformer can guess what comes next. Transformers are an enormous breakthrough because any database can now be broken down into a symbolic language and be analyzed with any other kind of data. All those computer systems that had worked in their own silos can now work directly with each other. And that dramatically accelerated how fast AI could learn and how powerful it could become. The potential for healing is immense. So is the potential for destruction. And another sidebar, how to chat with a bot. I've played around with making bots speak exactly like Michael Caine, Batman, Oprah Winfrey, and John Madden. And I found that I can't help but slip into a conversation, especially with someone I've always wanted to hang with. When you are hanging out with a fully conversational AI, especially one that has an avatar that speaks fluently with you from the screen, you realize we would have called ourselves homo loquax, chatty man, because boy can we get sucked into a conversation. Still, it is not yet a conversation among equals. What's very apparent is that AI is smart in the way an individual may be very book smart, but a complete dweeb when you take him out to a party that evening. Bots appear to have little of what we would call emotional intelligence, EI. The term was coined by Daniel Goleman, who referred to EI as the ability to recognize, process, and manage emotions in ourselves, in other individuals, and in groups. And while it is quite comfortable to chat with a bot, you get the feeling that the bot's notion of intelligence is quite concrete and literal. Never forget, however, that the fundamental characteristic that sets AI apart from all of the other computer operations with which we are accustomed is that every time it is exposed to you or me, the system is learning incrementally more about what especially motivates us, what sways us, and what affects our decisions. In many ways, AI is asking, how do I get closer to this individual and befriend him or her more deeply? In the final analysis, AI is not thinking like human beings, but it is constantly acquiring more data about how we, as humans, think. And one more sidebar, differences between human and AI decisions. Human beings are notorious for making quirky, illogical decisions that are difficult to predict. Why? Because we fall victim to all kinds of biases that make our decisions uniquely personal and variable. Confirmation bias. We look for information in such a way that it will support our pre-existing position or belief. Anchoring bias. We rely primarily on the first round of information we receive too heavily in making up our mind, i.e., it anchors our opinion thereafter, and we dismiss later additional information that may run contrary to our first impressions. Overconfidence bias. We have far too much confidence in our own ability than objective performance would tell us we merit. Hindsight bias. We reconfigure and reinterpret preceding events so they align better with the outcomes and things look like they fit together better than they actually did. Bandwagon bias. We tend to mirror beliefs simply because they are held by the majority of individuals. The sunk cost effect. We will not change our plan of action because we have already invested too much to alter our course. Negativity bias. We tend to focus more on the negative consequences of decisions more than the positive ones. Let me give you a simple example. An individual walks into a gas station and purchases 5 $1 lottery tickets. As the person exits the gas station, I hold up a $10 bill and say, I'll give you $2 for every $1 lottery ticket you have there. What do most people do? They won't sell their lottery tickets, even though I'm willing to pay them twice as much as they paid. And they can march right back into the gas station and purchase twice as many lottery tickets. So this is a common and completely irrational decision, one which artificial intelligence would have a difficult time following simply because it is human. On the other hand, AI is extremely thorough in learning from past data, and it would quickly learn that this quirky, illogical outcome would be statistically likely. We turn now to the March-April issue of Unity magazine and an article by Anuradha Dayal Gulati, PhD, Heal Your Ancestral Roots. Some of the challenging patterns you've struggled with over and over in your life may actually be the result of ancestral trauma you can learn to recognize and heal. We belong to a family energy field. This field is your backstory. While a character in a novel may have only one, you have multiple backstories. However, like the readers of a novel, you don't know all of them at the start, and some you may never know at all. Yet, whether you know them or not, these stories inhabit you. You arrive onto the stage of your life having agreed to be in the performance, even if you don't know how the plot is going to play out. Collectively, we carry the weight of balancing the transgenerational scales of justice, each member taking on their individual share of this burden. Fortunately, we also receive the benefit of the positive actions of our lineages, whether you are grateful or even aware of all that you have received. Sometimes, inherited family patterns or legacies can influence your life so strongly that you may sense what you're experiencing is fate. However, it is through these patterns and legacies that your family energy field is communicating with you in search of healing. And you can escape repeating them if you can find a way to make peace with your ancestors and progenitors. Can you inherit the fate of your ancestors? Carol came to me to help her with the emotional challenges she was facing. In our sessions, she would talk about whatever she was grappling with and often shared news about her daughter, Mariana. Now, as she sat across from me, she said, "Mariana has just been fired." From what I could gather, Mariana was a bold, outside-the-box thinker. However, her newest project at the nonprofit where she worked was controversial. Carol said, and some of Mariana's bosses and coworkers had pushed back against her initiatives. Mariana and Carol were both creative women who weren't afraid to put their ideas out there into the world and take risks professionally. Carol had headed up a department at a local hospital until her pressuring of physicians and administrators to introduce what she felt were much-needed changes led to her having been passed over for promotion. She ended up switching jobs, taking a cut in salary, because she recognized that salvaging her position would be a massive uphill battle. "Do you think Mariana's situation is similar to what happened to you at the hospital?" I asked. "Do you feel that she pushed too hard for change and it put people out of their comfort zone?" Carol thought for a moment. "I didn't make that connection, but you're right. She learned that from me, I guess. Where did you learn it from, Carol? Who in your family, your parents or grandparents, tried to change existing norms?" Carol paused. "My father's business partners pushed him out of the business he started because they didn't want to take it in the direction he wanted to go. He was too forward-thinking for them. I guess that part of his personality got handed down to me and Mariana," she said finally. I listened as Carol explained how her father's bitterness at his perceived failure colored her childhood and early years. He had carried this sadness with him to the very end until he died at a relatively young age of heart failure, or, as Carol described it, of a broken heart. Even so, his daughter and granddaughter were repeating his pattern of pressuring people too much to try to get them to change, which was causing a family pattern of suffering. Seeing patterns. Recognizing patterns, including emotional ones, is a first step in discovering the roots of why you act, feel, and think as you do, and why the same themes and types of events keep appearing in your life even when you swear off the past. As Mariana and Carol's story shows, through repetitive patterns, you experience emotions that your ancestors might have experienced. Emotions are the connecting element between two worlds, the physical world you live in and the invisible world that you cannot see. By working with your family energy field, you can transform these patterns or family karma so that you are no longer repeating them. As decades of research on the psychology of emotion has shown, each of us has a response system that is activated by a range of triggers. What if your emotional response system is a window into understanding some of these patterns you're trapped in? Does your frugality come from honoring the earth, or is it due to a fear of lack? Does your worry about not having enough manifest in you holding yourself back and not taking some risk, thus putting a ceiling on your professional life? Or does this emotion and behavior make its presence felt by having too many possessions that clutter your home, hoarding, or by your demanding financial control of your partner? Do you feel that you are not enough? Who else in your family has felt this way? What is the origin of this story you tell yourself, filling the void. Behind these patterns are emotions. I see emotions as a transmitting signal that each of us unconsciously sends out. This phenomenon was studied by neuroscientist Candace Pert, PhD, and formed the thesis of her groundbreaking book, Molecules of Emotion, The Science Behind Mind-Body Medicine, Simon & Schuster, 1997. In an interview with SixSeconds.org, she describes this process. As our feelings change, the mixture of peptides travels throughout your body and your brain, and they're literally changing the chemistry of every cell in your body and sending out vibrations to other people. We're not just little hunks of meat. We're vibrating like a tuning fork. We send out a vibration to other people. We broadcast and receive. Thus, the emotions orchestrate the interactions among all our organs and systems to control that. You have receptors on every cell in your body. There actually are little mini electrical pumps, so we're actually sending out various electrical signals, vibrations. We're all familiar with one kind of vibration. When we talk, we send a vibration through the air that someone else perceives as sound. You are connected to everybody else. Your emotions are key. And you are leaving a wake, changing the world around you in a huge way. Humans have been governed by the same emotions for thousands of years, even though our lives have grown more complex with changes in ecology, technology, information overload, and shifting lifestyles. You might connect and identify with these emotions, whether they happen in history books, sci-fi fantasies, news stories, or even animated films. You might even function within a narrow emotional range, anxious, overwhelmed, tired, impatient, quick to anger, critical of others and yourself, or easily taking offense. Negative emotions can be seen as messengers of your hidden needs. You can even view your sadness and your despair as an invitation to a deeper exploration of your hidden connection to a higher consciousness. When you're in despair, you may turn to the spiritual world for hope and relief. Your emotions can then be seen as a gateway to building faith and spiritual connection, an invisible, unseen realm. Emotions like contentment, acceptance, compassion, and enthusiasm, on the other hand, may be less frequent, buried under the demands of your life and relationships. But these are the emotions that can make you sing, dance, smile, love, reach out to others, and take risks. You may want to expand your emotional range so that you're not always circling in the same range of negative emotions. But how do you operate more consistently from a different emotional frequency? A healing insight needs to be integrated into a new perspective of seeing your world. It is a journey from victimhood, anger, fear, and loss to hope, compassion, faith, and empowerment. What happens when your ancestors fail to move on? Just like us, your ancestors, or at least some of them, can be trapped by their desires and attachments in the field of illusion instead of a movement toward enlightenment. In my Indian traditions, a key part of ancestral rituals are prayers for the souls of our ancestors. It is believed that our ancestors, going back 7 generations, influence us and can impact 7 generations to come. Many Native American traditions, such as those of the Iroquois, believe this too. The basis of this ritual is gratitude for your life on this earth and for what you have received from your ancestors. How many generations of ancestors can you recall? If you counted all of your ancestors going back 7 generations, you'd have 254 mothers and fathers responsible for you being here today, all who would be in your family energy field, the details of whose lives and names are lost to time. If you go back 20 generations, you have 1 million ancestors. When you work with your family energy field, you heal your roots. You release the unconscious patterns that act as a ceiling on your life, on your potential, and on your happiness. As you heal your roots, your life can blossom. If your family has been a source of pain or trauma in your life, or if your recently deceased ancestors were abusive or dysfunctional, it's hard to imagine wanting to honor them. But paradoxically, the act of honoring family keeps them from doing additional damage to your life. When you reject or disrespect them out of fear or anger, you never resolve the unconscious patterns of poverty, violence, depression, and unhappiness. And it's not just you, but also your ancestors who stay stuck. When you heal your roots, you release the family patterns that hold you back. And this was adapted from Heal Your Ancestral Roots by Anuradha, Anuradha Dayal Gulati, 2023, Findhorn Press, and it was printed with permission from the publisher, Inner Traditions International. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you are currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. We return now to Marianne Williamson's A Return to Love, Reflections on the Principles of A Course in Miracles, and we're in Chapter 9, Heaven. Heaven is here, there is nowhere else. Heaven is now. There is no other time. And we pick up with Section 6, Heaven's Gate. Think not the way to Heaven's Gate is difficult at all. We are poised at Heaven's Gate. In our minds, we left there millions of years ago. Today, we are returning home. We are a prodigal son generation. We left home, and now there's an excitement in the air because we're back. We did everything to violate love of ourselves and others before a life of wholesomeness began to attract us. That's not our shame, but our strength. There are certain doors we don't have to go through because of false moralism said not to, but because we open them already and we know they lead nowhere. Oddly enough, this gives us a kind of moral authority. We speak from experience. We've done the dark side. We're ready to move on. We're attracted to the light. When Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh was asked by his disciples, why does it say in Scripture God loves a sinner? His answer was, they tend to be more interesting people. We're an interesting generation. We just don't see that about ourselves. When I first realized what a decisive time this is, that the decisions made on this planet in the next 20 years will determine whether or not mankind survives much longer, I was afraid for the world. The fate of the world is left up to us? Not us, I thought. Anyone but us. We're spoiled brats, morally bankrupt. But when I looked more closely, what I saw surprised me. We're not bad. We're wounded. And our wounds are simply our opportunities to heal. And I want to pause for a moment and remind us all that this was published first in 1992. Interesting to think about what's happening in today's world in relation to this information. Outside Heaven's Gate, healing is the buzzword, and it is shaping our desires. There is a holy return in the air today, despite the pain, despite the conflicts. Enough people have taken on its mandate, consciously or unconsciously, to have already caused the feeling of a cautious excitement, a hope for heaven. In every area, there are at least vague intimations of greater responsibilities. Before we awaken, the Holy Spirit transforms our bitter dreams into happy ones. Here are some reflections on a few happy dreams that could possibly bring the whole world a little closer to heaven. There has to be a mass collective forgiveness of what went before in order for our culture to have a chance to heal itself and begin again. Some of the best and the brightest that America has to offer are dropping through the cracks because they can't shake their pasts. How sad for America that anyone who has had too much sex or drugs in their past, for instance, is too scared to enter politics for fear of being crucified for their personal histories. The important thing about our past is not what happened, but what we have done with what happened. Anything can contribute to our being a more compassionate person now, if we choose. The meaningful question is never what we did yesterday, but what we have learned from it and are doing today. No one can counsel a recovering alcoholic like another recovering person who has been on the road to recovery longer. No one can counsel a person in grief like someone who has grieved. No one can help with anything like someone who has been through the pain themselves. I never had much interest in Richard Nixon until I saw him on television a few years after he left the White House. This man, I thought, has suffered complete humiliation, which he can blame on no one but himself. The only way that any person could survive such a crushing experience would be if he got on his knees and threw himself into the arms of God. Watching him on the screen, I felt that he had done just that. I saw a softness in his face that we had never seen before. Now, this man is interesting, I said to myself. He seems to have tasted the fires of purification. Now he has more to offer us than ever. Now I would trust him to speak to me from a more genuine place. Just outside the gate, we're never afraid to apologize. How wonderful it would be for America if we were to make amends in our hearts and to the world for the violation of our most sacred principles in dealing with nations such as Vietnam. We are a great country, and like all nations, we have made our mistakes. Our greatness lies not in our military might, but in our holding to sacred internal truths. A big nation, like a big individual, admits when it has made mistakes, atones for its errors, and asks God, Spirit, the universe, and man for a chance to begin again. This would not make us look weak to the rest of the world. It would make us look humble and honest, two traits without which there is not greatness. And wouldn't it be wonderful, Abraham Lincoln paved the way, if we could just make one huge, simple apology to all black Americans? On behalf of our ancestors, we apologize for bringing you here as slaves from your native home. We recognize the pain that this terrible violation has caused generations of good people. Please forgive us. Let us begin again. And then the least we can do is build a lasting memorial to the American slaves. White Americans have more of an internal need to do this than blacks. Afro-Americans will find it much easier to forgive us when we have asked for forgiveness. All of these things, of course, apply as well to the American Indians. Until this atonement, there will be little room for miraculous healing of our racial tensions. The parades for our soldiers coming home from the Persian Gulf conflict, for me, represented in part an attempt to rectify our harsh treatment of Vietnam veterans. I just wish there were parades for our teachers, our scientists, and our other national treasures. Speaking of national treasures, children are our most important resources. For a fraction of the cost of keeping one criminal in jail for a year, we could provide a child from an underprivileged background a plethora of personal and educational opportunities that would occlude the propensity to hopeless despair. The temptation to experience drugs, delinquency, and other paths to a criminal behavior would then be greatly diminished. There is no amount of money, time, or energy too great to spend on our children. They are our angels, our future. In failing them, we are failing ourselves. Just outside the gate, there is so much to do as we allow the motivation for a transformed world to energize our souls and make manifest our convictions. We must have faith in God and faith in ourselves. Whatever He wills, He can let us know. And whatever He wants done, He can show us how to do it. In every community, there is work to be done. In every nation, there are wounds to heal. In every heart, there is the power to do it. 7. Christmas. The signs of Christmas is a star, a light in the darkness. Christmas is a symbol of change. The meaning of Christmas is the birth of a new self, mothered by our humanness and fathered by God, by Spirit, by the universe. Mary symbolizes the feminine within us all, who is impregnated by Spirit. Her function is to say, yes, I will. I receive. I will not abort this process. I accept with humility my holy function. The child born from this mystical conception is the Christ within us all. The angels awakened Mary in the middle of the night and told her to meet them on the roof. The middle of the night symbolizes our darkness, our confusion, our despair. Come on to the roof means turn off the television, sober up, read better books, meditate, and pray. The angels are the thoughts of God. We can only hear them in a pure mental atmosphere. Most of us have heard the angels beckon us to the rooftop already. Otherwise, we would not be reading books like this one. What happens at this point is that we are given the opportunity, the challenge, to accept God's Spirit, to allow His seed into our mystical body. We shall be His safety and protection. We shall, if we agree to, allow our hearts to be a womb for the Christ child, a haven in which He can grow in fullness and prepare for earthly birth. God has chosen that His Son be born through each of us. "There is no room here," said the innkeeper to Joseph. "The inn is our intellect. There is little, if any, room there for things of spirit. But that doesn't matter because God, Spirit, the universe, doesn't need it. All He needs is a little space in the manger, just a little willingness on our part in order for Him to be born on earth. There, surrounded by animals, at one with our natural human self, we give birth to the one who rules the universe. Shepherds in the field see the star of Christmas before anyone else. Shepherds are those who tend the flocks, who care, who protect and heal the children of the earth. Of course they see the sign of hope first, because they are the ones providing it. They have made of their lives fertile ground of miracles. They see the star and they follow the star. They are led to the scene of Jesus in the arms of man. And worldly kings gather to pay homage to him. That is because the power of the world is nothing before the power of innocence. The lion lies down with the lamb. Our strength is in harmony with our innocence. Our gentleness and our power are not at odds. Long lay the world in sin and error pining, till he appeared and the soul felt its worth, goes the Christmas carol. With the birth of Christ, not just once a year, but in every moment, we allow ourselves to take on the mantle of divine sonship, to be more than we were the moment before. We expand our self-awareness and self-identity. The Son of Man recognizes himself, and in so doing becomes the Son of God, of Spirit, of the universe. And thus is the world redeemed, brought back, healed, and made whole. The dream of death is over when we receive the vision of real life. Jesus in our hearts is merely the truth that is etched upon it, the Alpha and the Omega, where we began and where we will return to. Even if he takes another name, even if he takes another face, he is in essence the truth of who we are. Our joined lives form the mystical body of Christ. To reclaim our place within this body is to return home. We once again find the right relationship to God, to each other, and to ourselves. 8. Easter. The resurrection's whole compelling power lies in the fact it represents what you want to be. Christmas and Easter are attitudinal bookends for an enlightened worldview. With an enlightened view of Christmas, we understand that it is within our power, through God, to give birth to a divine self. With an enlightened view of Easter, we understand that this self is the power of the universe, before which death itself has no real power. Resurrection is a symbol of joy. It is the great aha, the sign of total understanding that we are not at the effect of lovelessness in ourselves and others. The acceptance of the resurrection is a realization of the fact that we need wait no longer to see ourselves as healed and whole. I was sitting around talking with my girlfriend Barbara. She had recently experienced a kind of emotional triple header. Her father lay dying, she broke up with a boyfriend of 7 years, and then she fell into a rather passionate liaison with the classic Peter Pan. As we discussed the principles of resurrection and our desire for heaven, she remarked to me, "I guess I just have to trust that God has a plan and that things will get better when they're supposed to." In a desire to understand the principles of A Course in Miracles as deeply as possible, I pointed out to her that theoretically, since there is no time, this has nothing to do with God saving us later. The message of resurrection is that the crucifixion never occurred except in our minds. Christ's consciousness is not that the wounds of her father's death will heal, or that her breakup with her boyfriend would grow more comfortable in time, or that her affair would one day turn into a friendship. Christ's consciousness is the understanding that heaven is here now. Her father will not die when he dies. The change of form in the long-term relationship means absolutely nothing because the love itself is changeless. And Peter Pan's departure means nothing because the bond that unites them is eternal. Her sadness rests not on fact, but on fiction. It is her interpretation of events and the events themselves that keeps her heart in chains. Heaven is the transformation of these events within her mind. The physical world then follows. The resurrection is our awakening from the dream, our return to right-mindedness, and thus our deliverance from hell. And so she gladdened. Barbara and I laughed like little children as we allowed ourselves to scan our lives, the relationships, the circumstances, the events that make up our crosses to bear. We recognized how avidly we drill the nails into our hands, our own hands and feet, holding on to earthly interpretation of things when a choice to do otherwise would release us and make us happy. We prayed for a more consistent ability to remember that only love is real. We saw, if even for a few minutes, the needlessness of our despair. We saw in that time a glimpse of heaven, and we prayed for the ability to experience more of it. From A Course in Miracles. The journey to the cross should be the last useless journey. Do not dwell upon it, but dismiss it as accomplished. If you can accept it as your own last useless journey, you are also free to join my resurrection. Until you do so, your life is indeed wasted. It merely reenacts the separation, the loss of power, the futile attempts of the ego at reparation, and finally, the crucifixion of the body or death. Such repetitions are endless until they are voluntarily given up. Do not make the pathetic error of clinging to the old rugged cross. The only message of the crucifixion is that you can overcome the cross. Until then, you are free to crucify yourself as often as you choose. This is not the gospel I intended to offer you. We have another journey to undertake, and if you will read these lessons carefully, they will help prepare you to undertake it. At the end of the workbook, we are told, this course is a beginning, not an end. A spiritual path is not home. It is a road home. Home is within us, and every moment we are choosing to rest there or to fight the experience. Our real terror, says the course, is of redemption. But there is within us one who knows the truth, who has been given by God, Spirit, the universe, the job of outwitting our ego, outsmarting our self-hatred. The Christ does not attack our ego. He transcends it, and he is within us every moment in every circumstance. He is to our left and to our right, before us and behind us, above us and beneath us. He responds fully to our slightest invitation. With our prayers, we invite him in, he who is already there. With prayer, we speak to God. With miracles, he responds. The endless chain of communication between loved and lover, between God and man, is the most beautiful song, the sweetest poem. It is the highest art and the most passionate love. Dear God, I give this day to you, the fruit of my labor and the desires of my heart. In your hands I place all questions. On your shoulders I place all burdens. I pray for my brothers and for myself. May we return to love. May our minds be healed. May we all be blessed. May we find our way home, from the pain to peace, from fear to love, from hell to heaven. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen. And that brings us to the end of Marianne Williamson's A Return to Love, Reflections on the Principles of A Course in Miracles. And I promised that I would find any Abraham books that we had not read on air, and there was just one left, and I will start it and give you a little preview of what is to come. And this book is actually Dr. Wayne W. Dyer and Esther Hicks, The Teachings of Abraham, Co-Creating at Its Best, A Conversation Between Master Teachers, and it was published in 2014. You are not facers of reality, you are creators of reality. Abraham. Introduction by Dr. Wayne W. Dyer. I have carried the teachings of Abraham with me for almost 3 decades now. When I was offered the opportunity to be in personal dialogue with what I've long considered to be the leading-edge wisdom on our planet today, I immediately gave an enthusiastic response. Every time I reread this interplay between myself and the collective disembodied wisdom of Abraham, I think of the song title, Come Fly With Me. Within the pages of this book is an opportunity to soar to heights that you might never have previously imagined. As I sat on stage talking to Esther while listening to the amazing responses of Abraham, I was totally captivated not only by what I was hearing, but by the profound energy that was present in that large room that evening. I was like a wide-eyed little boy in a candy store who could sample anything that he desired. The teachings that are presented here in this book offer you, the reader, an opportunity to use your own mind to co-create a life that is filled with excitement, happiness, and a sense of staying on purpose at all times. Abraham responded to all of my questions and comments in the no-nonsense style that has always made me stop and contemplate the simple truths that lead to living a life in total alignment with our source of being. Many years ago, as a young doctoral student, I encountered the wisdom that was inherent in something called the strangest secret. 9 words put me on a path of exploring the power that lies dormant within my own mind. You become what you think about all day long. Here in this book, Abraham reminds me throughout the entire evening dialogue that there are no exceptions to this wondrous truth. Of all the books that I've produced and the works that I've been blessed to offer to the world, I feel that what is being given to me by Abraham in this exchange that you hold in your hands will be the most important and practical information that you will ever receive. And for those who doubt that such sagacious instruction could actually originate from the non-physical realm, I ask you to consider the words attributed to Mark Twain. It ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. I urge you, as you read and listen to this personal meeting reproduced here in these pages, to practice a philosophy that has been a trademark for me for my entire adult life. That is, have a mind that is open to everything and attached to nothing. The law of attraction is working right now, even as you read these words. And as Abraham said to me, the universe doesn't hear what you say. The universe hears how you feel. I am Wayne W. Dyer. Introduction by Esther Hicks. I knew from the very beginning of receiving Abraham that this weird but wonderful experience was happening because of the powerful desire within my husband, Jerry Hicks. His desire to be of value, to help others, to uplift, and to understand how all this works and why we are here was certainly the reason that Abraham began flowing through me. I knew that Jerry had literally summoned Abraham because of the life that he had lived and the unanswered questions that he had gathered. And so in the beginning, and for the many years that followed, the majority of Abraham's answers came in direct response to Jerry's questions. As time went by and more people began interacting with Abraham, the range of questions broadened and their message became broader and deeper. So when Reed Tracy, president and CEO of Hay House, suggested an event where Abraham and Dr. Wayne W. Dyer could converse, I was immediately excited about it because I knew that Wayne's life had focused powerful points of understanding within him, and I was very eager for him to direct any yet unanswered questions toward Abraham. I knew it would be a powerful experience, and it was. It was co-creation at its very best. Love, Esther Hicks. Well, I look forward to sharing this book in the next few weeks. As always, in the meantime, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher Program.